culture and just believing in culture and the idea that actually culture is a competitive advantage is just really core to kind of who we are as a business. And I genuinely think that's true of whether you're, you know, three people or, you know, 300,000 people, the culture and the connection you have between those people is going to directly flow through to how your business performs.
It's the E-commerce Master Plan podcast, here to help you solve your marketing problems and grow your e-commerce business. Cutting through the hype to bring you inspiration and advice from the e-commerce sector and beyond. Here's your host, Chloe Thomas.
Hello and welcome. It's great to have you here. Thank you for hitting play and choosing to listen to one of our inspiring guests. I am super pleased to be able to bring you this guest. We have been trying to get someone from Cook on the show for a very long time. And earlier this year, I saw James, our guest today, put up a post about his strategic process and the strategic approach that has taken Cook to the phenomenal retailer here in the UK that it now is. So we thought, ooh, let's zone in on James and see if we can get him on the show. And Miriam, our podcast booker, managed it. Yes, we got James on the show. So we are talking about big picture strategy here. Great time of year to be doing it. This is when you should be, I know you're in the middle of peak, but you should be starting to work out what you're actually doing this year. Or as you're about to discover in this episode, you should have started months ago. But now is better than yesterday. It's better than tomorrow, rather. So prepare to discover the three key pillars of the Cook strategy for growth and lots of practical tips within all of this to build it into your business too. And make sure you listen to the end of the episode because James's top tips are very good as well. And now to introduce our special guest. James Rutter is the Chief Strategy Officer at Cook, home of award-winning frozen meals and puddings. Founded in 1997 and a B Corp since 2013, Cook now sell via their bespoke website, 111 shops across the UK and via wholesale. And in the last 15 years, they've grown from £30 million to being on track for £150 million in annual sales this year, of which about one-fifth is online. Hello, James.
Hello, Chloe. Delighted to be here. Looking forward to it.
Delighted to have you here too. So, James, before we get into Cook and strategy and all those great things, how did you end up in the world of e-commerce?
Gosh, yeah. Well, am I in the world of e-commerce? I guess I am. Yeah, I don't necessarily think of it quite like that. So I joined Cook more than 15 years ago. So that was my entry to e-commerce. As we had launched our website, I want to say in 2004, but I may be misremembering that. But it was, you know, we were fairly early in the grand scheme of things. So that was when I got into proper direct to consumer. But my previous career, I was actually a journalist for a kind of a dozen years. And so I lived through that whole kind of dot-com boom in the late 90s when suddenly the media industry in particular was kind of exploded by everything going online. So I had an earlier formative e-commerce experience, I suppose, during that whole revolution. I went and worked for a dot-com in America and then kind of that all went tits up. So I came back and, you know, so yeah. So I've seen it from a number of different angles.
Very cool. And you said you wouldn't necessarily class yourself as being in e-commerce now. Is it retail, you would say, at Cook you're in, or is it food, or is it... I'm just curious. I mean...
Yeah, so I think of us as being, we're a food business, but we're also a retailer. And what makes us really unusual is that we're vertically integrated. So we make everything we sell and we own everything in between as well. So we've got our shops on the high street. We've got our big kitchens making food. We own our own logistics, trucking everything around and our cold store, keeping it cool. And then all those central functions from, you know, all the obvious things, marketing, people, finance. So with 2,000 people, and I always say that we've kind of literally under our umbrella is all of humanity, because we're very unusual in the fact that we own that kind of what you might call a blue collar manufacturing type of business. And then we have our lovely cook shops on leafy high streets in lovely suburbs around the country. So it's a very interesting mix to try and bring all those people together into one business and feel like part of one business and all turn up and do an amazing job to deliver a great customer experience.
Yeah, of course, because you not only have you got the logistical and financial challenge of owning the whole thing and all the things that does to business and the opportunity as well, but you've also got, it's not like there's, you know, 20 head office people sat in a nice office building somewhere coming in and doing their 9 to 5. You've got a whole arena of different classes, backgrounds, interests, workflows, working stuff going on as well, without, you know, turning this into an HR podcast. Does being a B Corp help with that?
It helps to some degree, I guess. I think culture and just believing in culture and the idea that actually culture is a competitive advantage is just really core to kind of who we are as a business. And I genuinely think that's true of whether you're, you know, three people or, you know, 300,000 people, the culture and the connection you have between those people is going to directly flow through to how your business performs. And, you know, B Corp helps to an extent, but I think we'd do it all anyway. You know, I think the cultural stuff is so strong within how we operate that it would be there regardless. But I do think having some kind of framework which helps you think about culture intentionally is really important, whether that's B Corp, whether it's something of your own devising or something like we do the best company survey every year, and that gives us a framework. So in a sense, that's a helpful framework to look at our culture through that lens. But having something that is meaning you sit down and think about, oh, actually, how is our team? How are they doing, you know, as people as well as colleagues? How do we help them do better? Because we want to do better. Having that kind of framework in place is so important, so valuable. Like I say, whether you're a mini little tiddler or a massive company at the other end of the spectrum.
So I'm sure we'll get back into that in a minute, but I just want to let the audience know, you know, a couple of bits of background before we go deeper, which is that the reason I've invited you on is not just because Cook is an amazing business, but it's also because you put up a LinkedIn post a couple of months ago about the three essential ingredients for long-term success at Cook, which were the strategic clarity, cultural energy, and brand vitality. Should we go through them in order, James, or should we just take that cultural angle first? Where do you want to go?
We can stick with culture as we're there. We can stick with culture. Yeah.
Excellent. So I love that you pointed out about how having the framework and the structure to actually sit down and think about it. Because I think a lot of businesses, the culture piece, the values piece, the whatever you call it, it's like something which someone did a project on in 2019, and then it got put in a drawer. It occasionally gets bought out at an all-company meeting to make everyone feel good, and then it gets ignored again for a couple of years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it's the actual real commitment, not just lip service, that makes the difference. Or is it the framework you pick? You know, what's the key thing?
I think the key thing is genuinely believing in it and having the sense that people properly motivated, properly energized with that idea that they're doing something valuable, people will just make the difference. Even in this AI world, you know, people will still make the difference for your business. And so what are you doing to enable your people to give their best for your cause? You know, if you own or run a business, surely that's what you want. Or if you manage a team, that's what you want, is to make sure people give their best. And that's all culture is. It's really just thinking about, okay, how are we going to show up so that we give our best? So like I say, it's not necessarily which framework you pick, but it's having one and it's believing in it. There's this guy, I can't remember his surname, something McGregor, back in the 60s. He had this sense that actually there's a theory X and a theory Y about people. And theory X says that, like, people are just self-interested, lazy, good for nothings, and need a good prod and a good stick and a good battering to do anything with value. And theory Y says that people are actually really self-motivated, energized individuals who've given the opportunity will do their best. And McGregor's thing was, look, either you tend to believe in X or Y. And in the 60s, there were plenty of people in the X camp. Hopefully, there's fewer of those now, but I'm sure we all come across some that perhaps do still definitely live up to that idea.
It was not totally meaning to tangent us here, but I think one of the depressing things that came out, I mean, a lot of depressing things came out of the pandemic, but one of the business depressing things was realizing how many big business bosses have zero trust in their staff. You know, when sales for spyware on people's computers, you know, you can take a screenshot, you know, a photograph of them every hour without them realizing to check they're still at their desk, you know, and then the absolute conviction that if someone's not physically in your office, they couldn't possibly be doing anything worthwhile. I found that quite depressing.
Yeah.
You know, which would be system, you know, one of those two ways of thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, which you just kind of like, how do people want to live like that? Because being the boss of a business like that is a lot harder work as well, I would argue.
Oh. Must be miserable though, and
yeah,
constantly paranoid. I think, you know, a good way to think about it, or a useful phrase again, which I think applies no matter what size team you're working with, is that how do you make everybody feel like an insider? Because really what people want is to feeling really engaged with something, they're part of the journey. And yet, as we tend to, you know, if we kind of move up the seniority ladder or whatever, we start to hoard information and you know, all the secrets we've got. Whereas actually, you just need to open up and make sure everybody feels like they know what's going on, that they're an insider in the business. And that is such a simple thing to do. All that requires is being open and honest. Sometimes it might, I think a lovely thing to do is like to send out a regular email if you're a boss. Actually, this is what I've been up to. This is what we've been up to. Oh, I was in that big meeting the other day. This is what happened. It's that sense in which actually, if you let that information flow down, that will be so valuable in terms of the effort that comes back up.
I love that take. It's kind of like, if you're going to build culture as well, the other thing I've always felt, and if you know, feel free to contradict me here, you are far more of an expert in this than I am, but it's, you can't go top down hoarding information. You also can't go top down, oh, by the way, everybody, here's our culture. You know?
Yeah.
It has to be not necessarily ground up. It has to be almost a swirling pool that involves everybody to actually work out what it is and then to define it and to let it evolve over time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for a time, if you're small, that can be quite organic. You know, that sense in which if you're all sat in the same room and you can shout over to each other and it's all just got that sense of we're in it together, that's fine. But if you grow, there will be a point at which you do want to put a bit more of a framework around it. And I mean, for us at Cook, it was, gosh, what was it? 2012, I think it was. But we, you know, by that stage, we were kind of 500 people in total. But we kind of figured out, oh, hold on, we're no longer meeting everybody who joins. And the way that you used to be able to just kind of do values and behavior by osmosis no longer quite works. So that's the point that we put in place. You know, we created values again, went out to the team to go back in and made sure that was a kind of co-created exercise, but had those very clear values in place so that that could take us from, you know, 500 people to 2,000 we are now. But those values, I think, have been fundamental to enabling that growth.
And I think implicit in what you were just saying is that if you don't hire the right people in the first place, you're on a losing wicket. Well, hence why so important at that recruitment stage. But as a business, you've made the, this is going to sound really privileged, but it's not how I mean it, but you've made the recruitment process much trickier with the Raw Talent program, where you are doing what pretty much every business ought to be doing, which is trying to help the most disadvantaged in society, which I'm assuming was a big leap in the culture place, or was it culture that enabled that? Could you explain more about the policy? Because I have not explained it, but did your cultural abilities make that, or cultural strengths make that process easier or harder?
So Raw Talent is a program we've been running for almost 11 or 12 years now. And Raw stands for Ready and Working. And it's all about providing people with big barriers to employment an opportunity to get into work and have a kind of thriving career and feel like their life's going somewhere. And so we draw from prison, so people who've been in prison, people who've perhaps been out of work for a long time, like long-term unemployed, very, very hard to often get back into work, people who may be suffering with mental health issues. So it's people who've got these big barriers to getting a job. And it came from, honestly, it came from, I think, our heart as a business to want to help people. And the fact that we do have a kind of big kitchen where we're making food means there are entry-level jobs that we could offer in a fairly straightforward way. So that's not true of many businesses. But it wouldn't have worked without us having, I guess, even if it was innate at that point and not particularly formalized, the cultural strength that people would trust us. So to say to somebody who's working in a team in a kitchen, oh, you're now going to have somebody come in and stand beside you working who's been in prison, has the potential to kind of create some friction or some ripples, put it that way, in the water. So being very open about it, but throughout the whole process it was coming into being, but also then being very responsive to people's concerns was a big part of it. But that program now, like I say, has been going more than 10 years. We just celebrated, I think, our 250th job that we've given through that program. And it's not just about that individual. It's about, if you think about them as just the nub of a load of relationships, it's their family, it's their friends, it's the broader community. So how that ripples out is just, you know, just a privilege to be part of. And I should say absolutely nothing to do with me. It's other people other than me who put in the hard work on it.
Okay, so the first of your sustainable success three essential ingredients, which we skipped over, is strategic clarity. What does that one mean?
So strategy has, I think, this tendency to be a little bit scary to everybody and to feel like, oh, I know I'm meant to have one, but I don't know what it is. Or, oh, I know I'm meant to have one, so I've done this really complicated PowerPoint deck to explain to everybody what it is. And so really it's about just saying, look, if you want to get somewhere you've got this big ambition to do something, to arrive in a certain place in the future, how are you going to lay out the clear kind of things you're going to focus on to get there in one page? Let's make it one page that anybody could look at and see, oh, I get where we're going, why we're going there, and how, in kind of the big picture way, how we think we're going to get to that point. And it's just something that I think people are a bit scared of. And so often run away from. So I think just having that real clarity as a business. So we've now had a strategic framework that fits on one piece of paper. It's been basically the same for about a decade. We tweak it, but the shape of it stays the same. It's got consistency. Consistency, again, is really important. You know, if you're really clear and consistent. And so everybody knows where they're going. So some of it is just demystifying strategy. And again, I think that's whether you're a little business or a big business, the same things apply. And I've kind of got what I think is kind of seven laws of strategy, as it were. And so the first one is like thinking about like what's your difference? So, and again, this can apply to whether you're a really small business. So, and don't think of that by degree, you know, we're better than other people at doing this. Think of it by kind. So actually we offer this thing in a totally different way to everybody else in the market. Because that's, without that, you're just going to be part of this big morass cloud of stuff. You're not going to have really much of a chance of getting anywhere. It's going to take a lot of work. So like the OG of strategy, this guy called Michael Porter, who kind of wrote all these kind of big strategic tones back in the 80s. So he kind of said, establish a difference you can preserve. And that's kind of the bulk of it. Or the nub of it, rather. That's the heart of it. So whether that's your business, it's like, okay, so, or our business, like, what's the difference we've got? How do we preserve it? So think of like strategy as difference. And then it's like, strategy has got to be doing something. So you've got the difference, but what are you doing differently? And how you deliver that thing, how is it different from how everybody's doing it? So again, back to Porter, yeah. How do you have a different set of activities that deliver this unique mix of value? That was his little quote. So the way everything fits together is probably different from how it fits together at the place down the road that might do something that the untrained eye looks similar. So again, what are you doing differently? Actually do it. Then this idea like strategy is choice. So you've got difference, you've got doing, you've got choice. You've got to choose. And those choices are probably going to be painful. And if they're not, you probably aren't trying hard enough. You know, if you're not saying, oh, I really want to do that, and I really want to do that, but I know I can only do one of them, and so I'm not going to do the other thing, you're probably not being clear enough about your strategy. So it's a really good test for yourself, right? Even if you're looking at the next 3 years, right, we're going to do this thing. What am I not going to do? And does that feel painful? And if it doesn't feel painful, then probably you're putting some stuff in there that you should not be doing, but you just can't quite bear to not do it. So you know, so make sure it's painful, you're choosing. So what we've got? We've got difference, doing, choice, creative. So again, I think lots of people think strategy is all about having loads of spreadsheets and numbers and loads of analysis. But actually in the first place, it's about being creative, the creative thinking about actually what is it we're trying to achieve? Where are we trying to get to in the world? And that's kind of, it's imagination. So you need the imagination bit first, and because then it goes on to like the fifth thing is like the killer question. So you kind of got this different thing you're going to be doing in the future, but what would need to be true for that to be the right choice? So this is a great question. It's from a book called Playing to Win. It's kind of called the reverse engineering question. So you come up with a destination first, and then you think, oh, what would have to be true for that to be a great strategy? And then you start going back, kind of almost reversing out of that end position and thinking about, oh, actually, if it requires the world to be blue and for everybody to be kind of wandering around in a toga, then probably my strategy isn't going to work. So you can start to reveal whether it's just wishful thinking. So that's five. So it's risky. Number six, you've got to accept strategy is going to be risky because you're saying this is a future we want to create. There's no guarantees. We're going to have to do some stuff to get there. So accept it's risky. And then finally, the kind of clarity one, number seven, strategy is a single page. So you've got to get it on a one page, because if it's on more than that, it's not clear and concise enough for you to tell everybody in the team and get them on board and know you're in a good place to go. So there you go. That's my seven.
Very nice. I love that. And I love the way it kind of like goes crazy wide and then pulls itself back in, which is obviously the process you need to go through to actually create a good strategy.
Yeah, completely.
How often, you said about it hasn't really changed in 10 years. Is that the strategy or the framework hasn't changed?
That's the framework. So, the strategy isn't that different, to be fair. You know, is it, like I say, it's evolved a bit. But we have a really good rhythm to how it works. And again, I think within your business, if you get into a rhythm, that makes sense. So our financial year runs 1st of April to 1st of April. So, you know, and usually in June, we'll get together as the kind of the senior team to talk about the strategy. We have a few days out and we'll be looking definitely much further ahead. But into that process, we'll have taken soundings from across the business. Then we'll come out of that with some thoughts about, oh, actually, what do we need to be looking at? So we'll go away, do some more work over the summer, come back in the autumn, usually around October time, to narrow down, if you like, our strategic choices for the next year into more of a plan. Then we go into budgeting through the winter, launch it in the spring, cycle starts again. But that kind of rhythm to it really works. And again, you're kind of, then you can look far out, come back in closer a bit, look far out again. So having just that system that works means everybody's on the same rhythm and it's not haphazard. And it obviously feeds into budgeting, but it does help.
And you've clearly, with that rhythm, given yourself time to sense check as the, you know, the deliverables and the actions that are going to be taken to achieve the strategy get decided. It's not like, oh yes, in December, on the first, we have a meeting, on the second, we ask the team, on the third, we do this. It's a drawn out space. There's time to investigate, research, sense check, and so on.
Absolutely. There's genuinely no surprise. By the time it comes to actually having to do stuff, there's zero surprises. And I'm sometimes amazed, you know, when I talk to other businesses, you know, quite big, you know, maybe not huge, but, you know, maybe 10, 20 million. And it's like, oh yeah, we do what you were just saying. We have a meeting on December the 1st, quickly sign off the budget and then tell everybody on like the 1st of January, here's the plan for the year ahead. And you think, geez. Poor people. Again, it's like making everybody feel like an insider, so they know what's coming. They know the kind of the big issues that you're wrestling with, the choices you're trying to make. And so it's not just no surprises for the kind of the people at the top. It's no surprises for anybody, because hopefully they've been bought into that process the whole way through. And importantly, had the opportunity to throw in their ideas and their kind of to Penneth Worth about, I can't believe we're not doing X, Y, or Z, you know, give people that opportunity.
Yeah, it's, and we all know fundamentally that we are programmed as human beings to be more into things that we had a role in creating. So it simply will help deliver better at the end of it all. Now, the third one, brand vitality. I mean, clearly built by both of the two pieces you've already taken us through, but how does this one function?
So I think this is then all about how do you take, you know, you've got that nice clear strategy, you've got the team that's hopefully then energized around it. And then it's right. So how do you take that out to the world in a way that is going to really resonate? And so I, you know, unsurprisingly from what we've been through, I'm kind of this big believer in that brands work from in to out, that kind of, that you really have to feel it inside before you can hope for anybody to feel it outside. So genuinely that real kind of cultural strength is what filters through to people in the outside world. And so then it's all about just thinking about, okay, so how do we make that story resonate with our target customers? What is it that's really going to connect with them on an emotional level? And again, you know, we at Cook, we're big into kind of this idea of community, and actually what we're doing here, you know, we're creating a workplace community for us at Cook, but actually wherever we have a shop, we're part of a community. You know, we're physically there. And how can we contribute to that community? How can people connect with us through it? And then, in the virtual space, in the e-commerce space, again, how does that become a community where people can actually participate, not just purchase, but actually feel like they're part of something that's both important to them because they love the products, but important to the wider world? So it's just kind of having that real kind of, like, say, vitality is a lovely way of thinking about it. How does your brand really have life in it? You know, where does that life come from? So many brands we encounter feel tired. You know, you can usually tell where there's life and where there isn't. So that really comes across, that kind of that fizz that a great brand has.
It feels like, you know, you've built the strategic clarity for the business, and then the cultural energy is all about bringing the team together and making sure everyone's in the right place. And then the brand vitality is almost flipping the mirror from the internal view to the external view, you know, because you're talking again about getting the customers involved and getting that. I mean, I'm not even going to bother asking you, do you get customer feedback on new product ideas? Because blatantly, it'd be insane if you didn't. It's a stupid question.
We could always get more, to be honest. I think, you know, participation is one of those things that you can never get too much, in a way.
For anyone who's listening to this and who's thinking, yeah, I get it, but I've no idea how to make it happen, where do they start on building more sane strategy, culture and brand vitality into their business? Because a lot of businesses play, you know, tick box activity with this. Oh, yes, we've done the strategy, chuck it in the drawer. Yes, we've got cultural stuff going on. Oh, yes, we know what the brand is. How do they make it a living, breathing thing? Where does that start?
It always starts with kind of sitting down and being really hard with yourself to a degree. And, you know, not scraping away all the kind of the little lies you tell yourself about how great things are and saying, look, really, do we have a really clear strategy? Could I go out of this room and tell somebody what it was? And would they then think, oh, that sounds awesome? You know, I wouldn't be part of that. So it really starts just with hard truths, being prepared to do that, asking yourself those tough questions, confront the brutal facts, I think was how, who says that? His name's gone from my head. Good to great guy, Jim Collins. Confront the brutal facts is such a wonderful phrase. So take away all that stuff that says, we think we're the best at doing this. Really? Are we? Is there evidence for that? What's the real objective truth about it? So just, you've got to start by being honest and then comfort yourselves with the fact that it's not as hard as people might make out, that it's just a process you can go through. You might need a bit of help, but you'll get there. You'll get through that process. Sometimes the little magic needs to come in the end, you know, brand in particular, something where some people are great, some people are less good, but you can always find help to bring those things to life. So just trust in the process, but don't believe your own bullshit. It's that, you know, we all love to delude ourselves about how great we are. Of course we do. So just start by confronting the brutal facts and go from there. Don't get depressed. That's the tough thing. Confront the brutal facts, but don't get depressed, because that Jim Collins thing was all built on the fact that Confront the Brutal Facts was a guy who was a prisoner of war in Vietnam. And he was tortured. He was there as being held captive. And he noticed that actually the people who were really optimistic and said we'd be home by Christmas, they were the ones who suffered the most. They were immediately disillusioned. They really struggled. The people who just said, oh, I'm never going to get out of here, we're doomed again, you know, they suffered. But the people who confronted the reality of they were in, but didn't lose hope that they would get out, that confronting the brutal facts, but then always having that belief that they would get out, those are the people who actually persevered, you know, came out of it the best at the other end. So that's where that comes from. It's like, confront the brutal facts, don't lose hope.
E-commerce Master Plan is supported by some of the greatest companies in the e-commerce sector. Here's a reminder of who they are. It's time for the top tips round.
Okay, I love this section because it gives me and our listeners some really quick ideas for taking our businesses to the next level. James, are you ready for the top tips?
I'm ready.
I'm not even sure I should ask you the first one because you've given us so many great book recommendations already, but let's do it. The book top tip. If everyone listening to this podcast agreed to take Friday off and read a book to make their business better, which book would you recommend?
So all the episodes I listen to, everybody's cheated and picked two. So I'm going to pick two.
They always cheat.
Yeah. So one to read. So this is a good place to start if you're kind of feeling like you don't have the strategy. Wonderful little book called No Bullshit Strategy by Alex Smith. You don't have to agree with it, but the questions it will pose to you will be worthwhile going through. Great book. Literally really small. Won't take you all day, but the questions are great. And then a book to listen to. So my favorite audiobook I've listened to this year is called Stories Sell by a guy called Matthew Dix. And it's brilliant because it shows you how the power of personal storytelling can transform your business. And it's great in audio because he lived a crazy life and he tells a mean story. So it's great to listen to because it's just so engaging, but it will give you this idea that I could tell stories to really bring my business to life.
Such a good piece of advice for this year, because story, as we all know, creative and story is becoming ever so more important. Love those two. Thank you. The traffic top tip, which marketing method do you either prize above all others or think doesn't get the press it deserves?
Without a doubt, email. And again, I can't see why anybody wouldn't be anything than in love with the opportunities there are from email to build great customer relationships. So we have a huge email list. We have an amazing engagement. And that's how you create a direct relationship with your customer.
It is mad how people think email isn't worth doing. It befuddles me.
Me too. And I think the interesting thing, though, is to then view email not just as a selling, marketing and sales tool, but as a relationship building tool, and recognize that hardly anybody in the world wants to get an email from your business every week. You know, they just don't care about you that much. So what is it that you're offering in that email that gives them something else, that is that sense of who you are as a brand? That's that brand vitality. What makes your brand come to life is going to be useful, entertaining for somebody, and isn't buying a product. And email is just such a wonderful way to create that connection.
Yeah, you're preaching to the converted in me, but hopefully we've converted a few more of the audience. Tool top tip, maybe a collaboration tool, a social media plugin, a phone app, or just a way of working. Is there a cool little tool you use that makes you and your team more efficient from day to day?
So this is a culture tool, and it is potentially revolutionary for your business. And it is a postcard. Send somebody in your team a postcard telling them how much you appreciate them and what for. And just watch the appreciation bloom and multiply within your team, within your culture. Write somebody a note.
Would you deliver it in person, or would you literally send it through the post, chuck a stamp on it and let it be a proper surprise?
I think through the post is always better. But you know, the price of a stamp these days.
Well, like, yeah.
but make it physical. Don't make it an email. You know, if you really can't do the whole physical thing, an email's better than nothing. But, you know, there's so much power in that sense of a handwritten note that just says, you did this thing amazingly well. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for being on the team. That will pay you back in spades. And, you know, so there's a guy who did it, CEO of Campbell Soup, reckoned he sent 30,000 notes over the space of like 8 or 9 years. Because it's such a powerful tool to kind of bring people with you, to make people feel noticed, affirmed and needed. Are great little three things why people feel they matter when they're noticed, affirmed and needed.
Nice. That's like two tool tips there. I like it. Okay, the carbon top tip. What's your favorite way to reduce the carbon footprint of an e-commerce store?
So I think the reality is in e-commerce, it's the stuff you sell that's the real carbon footprint. Yeah, unless you're a knowledge business, of course. But so think about that first. And if you thought about that, so just reuse packaging is such an obvious thing. So our local delivery business, we reuse all the boxes that our food is delivered to the shops in. So then somebody buys online, it's delivered from the shop, we reuse those boxes. And look, I brought one because I couldn't remember. So there's a box. I'm showing Chloe a lovely cook box here. And on the top it says, this is the Harrison Ford of cardboard boxes. Sure, it's a bit rough around the edges, but it's loved. It's got tales to tell. Before your home delivery, it was used to get food from our kitchens to our shops. Reusing it means we can cut down on packaging and save carbon emissions. After all, it's what's inside that counts. So again, turning a reused box into a lovely little bit of brand vitality.
Love that. And it's a very good looking reused box, listeners, I can confirm. So James, thank you so much for that. Before we say goodbye, could you please let the listeners know where they can find you and Cook on the web and social, please?
Sure. So hopefully there will be a Cook near to you in the UK, if you're in the UK, or find us online at cookfood.net. And you can find me on LinkedIn, just search for James Rutter, or my own website is james-rutter.com.
And via james-rutter.com, you're helping a few businesses follow this strategic process as well, aren't you, I believe?
Yeah, that's right. So I now split my time between Cook for 3 days a week and doing my own thing for two.
Very cool. So get in touch, everybody, if you are intrigued and interested. James, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been fascinating seeing how you and the team at Cook have built such an impressive performance over the last few years. So thank you so much for being up for sharing it.
Thank you, Chloe. Loved it.
So for anyone thinking of getting in touch with James for your help on his strategy, on your strategy rather, he just properly grilled me both post-podcast, and in like 10 minutes I got a load of really interesting insights. So I would highly recommend speaking to James about your strategic challenges. Right, so back to the podcast. What were we just talking about? James was taking us through the three key elements that Cook have used over the last 10, 15 years to see this astronomical growth: strategic clarity, cultural energy, and brand vitality. And as you've just listened to it, you know how well those three weave together. I particularly liked his seven parts to building that strategic clarity and the way it kind of opened up your mind to different things and then subtly closed it back down again to really drill down to what's actually going to work. So thoroughly enjoyed my chat with James. Really pleased we could get him on the show. You can get your hands on our notes from this episode, including those top tips, all those many books he referenced during it, a juicy book references there, and the links to what we mentioned by heading over to ecommercemasterplan.com. You can also use our direct episode short links. So ecmp.info/the-number-of-the-episode will get you to any of the correct pages on the website, no matter what episode you're listening to. When you get to the website, you can also add yourself to our email list. Go on, you know you want to. Now, if you like this episode, then make sure you check out episode 554 with Ian Macbeth from Oak Furniture Land. Yes, another massive bricks and clicks business here in the UK, where we covered a lot of similar topics and a lot of other topics too. And if you want to listen to more big businesses on the show, then head to ecmp.info/big. Thank you for tuning into this and every episode of the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. I bring you a new interview every week because I want to inspire and help e-commerce business owners like you to succeed and thrive with your businesses, including progressing along the path to net zero. So if you know someone this show can help, please tell them to listen to the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. I hope you have a great week, and don't forget to keep optimizing.
Thank you for listening to the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. Find out more at ecommercemasterplan.com/podcast.